You know, if you've all come out, I think, probably because you're very interested in the subject of creation and evolution. You've probably heard a lot about it. And for a lot of people in the Christian world, it's been something of a frustrating subject. You're probably aware that there have been fundamentally three different positions in this debate up till now. First, there's the position of naturalistic evolution, taught in the schools of this state now as fact, and elsewhere in the country as well, and presented on television, for example, in programs like Carl Sagan's notorious Cosmos series. You remember Carl Sagan began that by saying the cosmos is all there is, ever was, or ever will be, and the message was throughout that purely natural, material, purposeless processes produced everything that is, including all living things, including ourselves, and we are therefore an accident of this process, and there is no purpose and meaning to the entire thing. Well, that's naturalistic evolution. It's the official position of the scientific establishment, the science education establishment, the state of California. You might even say it's the established religion of our country. Second is a position in direct opposition to this naturalistic evolution. Goes by the name of biblical creationism or creation science. And it is devoted to explicating the creation account in the book of Genesis, defending it from the criticism and rejection of the naturalistic evolutionists, dealing with difficult questions of interpretation, and producing scientific evidence and arguments to back up whatever the particular person believes is the correct interpretation of the Genesis account. Now, this position creates inherently a situation of a Bible science conflict. And it is a position which has had considerable influence in this country. Tens of millions of people adhere to this position. But it's a position which has not been at all successful in escaping from what one might call a Christian ghetto. It's a position regarded with tremendous suspicion and hostility, not only by the naturalistic evolutionists, but by a lot of other people as well, it has had no success in challenging the naturalistic evolutionists in the great universities, on the public television programs, in the secular intellectual world generally. Now, the third position that's long been established in this debate is something that usually goes by the name of theistic evolution. It's an attempt to bridge the gap between the other two positions. It's a position that tends to dominate in the Christian colleges, Christian educational institutions, of a center to liberal a variety. And this essentially takes the form of saying that what the scientists are saying about evolution is in one way or another compatible with Christianity. We don't have to worry about it. We can believe pretty much everything that they believe and then interpret it as the way that God is working things out. And I think many people have found that this third position is sometimes difficult to tell from the first position. That is to say that what it accepts it seems to be so naturalistic. It seems to be so materialistic, seems to be so lacking in any sense of a creator's participation, that it isn't really clear what the theistic adds to the evolution. And perhaps it seems sometimes only to be a form of words added to an acceptance of a position whose philosophical implications are very hostile, not only to Christian theism, but even to a theism of any other variety, Jewish or Islamic theism, for example. And these three positions have pretty much defined the world of discourse. Is a new and different approach possible? Now, obviously, I think a new and different approach to this whole controversy is possible. I think it's possible to change the ground rules. I think it's possible to change the entire way in which the creation-evolution controversy is understood in this culture. That's what I'm here to talk to you about today. I'm going to begin by telling you just a little bit about how I come to be here, how I came to take on this topic, where I'm coming from in approaching it, as it were. Kurt Hamner has already mentioned that he'd become familiar with my testimony. I won't give it all tonight because that's really the subject of a lecture in itself. It's a very public sort of thing because I was interviewed by the California Alumni Monthly and gave a very candid interview, much to my terror afterwards. But in fact, the editor-in-chief of the Alumni Magazine reported everything very well and accurately, and it went out to all the alumni at the University of California. So I've pretty much been flushed out into the open on this matter. It's become sufficiently notorious that I learned recently I was the subject of a sermon series at a very large Bible church in the Midwest. I won't name so that none of you can go looking up the sermon, because the series began with a sermon about my personal story, and the theme of it was that it's possible for anyone to be converted to Jesus Christ. That the hardest possible case, you know, no sinner is so sunk in degradation, etc. I was very interested. Somebody, well, a member of the congregation sent me the tape and said I thought I'd really enjoy it. I did because, well, of course, what the pastor meant, it wasn't at all insulting. What he meant was that he felt that a Berkeley professor, a senior professor, was probably the hardest case he could imagine to evangelize. Now, I grew up in a nominal Christian family in a Midwestern town, and when I went away to Harvard College as a very young man with a certain amount of ability but not a great deal of maturity, I felt that I'd left all of those small things behind, including the not very strong religious upbringing I'd had. But, you know, even the most nominal kind of Christian upbringing, I feel that it stuck with me much more than I ever realized, that the questions that it raised were in my mind even through a period when I thought I had nothing whatever to do with that small-town Christian church background. And what I wanted, putting all of this aside, was to be a big intellectual success, a big hit in the big-time world of secular intellectual life. I wanted to be a professor. I wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't want to be a lawyer too much at first, as a matter of fact, because my father wanted me to be a lawyer, and I sort of in principle didn't want to do anything my father wanted me to do. But after a stint teaching school in Africa, I didn't have a good enough reason to refuse to go to law school, and so I did, and ended up doing very well and thus pleasing my father immensely. Eventually ended up with a very successful academic career, became a professor at Berkeley, had a wife and a family of children, and I really felt that I had the whole thing. I was sufficiently arrogant and sufficiently ignorant to think that, you know, people like myself would be able to do a much better job of life in general than our parents have been able to do. I thought, well, just, you know, how could I possibly make any mistakes? I really have it all figured out. I understand it. I have this success. Well, then, of course, naturally, this was all that pride that goeth before a fall, and I had the fall. I went through, in my mid to late 30s, a deep personal and intellectual crisis. The personal crisis grew out of a failed marriage. My wife and I grew further apart, and all of the currents of California in the 1970s, I probably don't have to tell you a whole lot about. I went through our family, and she told me one night that as she was going to leave, it was a Thursday night, she was going to leave the coming weekend. And it was on the next night, the Friday night, that I attended my daughter's Bible week of study, the final night, at a local church. She was going there, by the way, just because another child in the neighborhood was going and asked her along. It had nothing to do with our family, but they wanted a parent to go for the final night of this Bible school week. And it was at that time, not really that I was converted, it didn't quite happen like that, but that I saw another way of thinking about things, and it really became a realistic possibility for me when I saw the tremendous faith of the pastor at that church and understood that he really meant what he was saying. Now, this personal crisis went along with an intellectual crisis, which was really just as important. Because here I was, I had found that I had gotten to the kind of position in academic life, was already, really even by then, a senior professor at Berkeley, And I'd written textbooks in law and had not, I would say, a spectacular academic career, but a solidly a successful one, everything I'd really, really wanted to have. And I felt it was tremendously unfulfilling. And what I had a deep sense of was that persons like myself were spinning our wheels, playing academic games, and never really getting anywhere. When I was young in law school, I remember the professors used to say it was terrible that none of the brightest lawyers in the country went into criminal law, that none of the people at the universities and the law schools wanted to teach it. Well, my generation went into it in a big way. We taught criminal law. We got involved in it. We thought great thoughts about it. We published papers. We did legislative proposals. And we made a complete mess of it. And I felt that there was something wrong with the whole way that we were thinking about that problem, about everything else. It was really difficult to think our way out of the problems that we'd created. So I had this deep sense of intellectual dissatisfaction, professional dissatisfaction. These personal and intellectual professional crises culminated in my conversion in the late 1970s. Now, I'll just tell you that, you know, I've had just enormously fulfilling experiences after that, including my second marriage and with Kathy, who's here with me now. But that won't be the story for tonight, because I'm going to tell you mainly about what fell out from that sense of intellectual malaise, that sense that none of us really knew where we were going. In the academic life, that no matter what we tried to do, it came out with the same relativism, the same nihilism, the same real absence of values. And I wanted to do something different about that. I wanted to be able to think differently about the whole problems of our culture, but I found that this was very hard to do without really getting to the bottom of things. And to get to the bottom of things, you have to look over a whole lot of things and decide what's really important, what's really influencing this culture, what's really having the effect of making things seem to be in such a state of futility. Well, Kathy and I were in London for the academic year 1987-88. I had a lot of time to read and think, and I happened to have an office at London University with no duties at all, very fine arrangement that I recommend for everyone, and it was right next to London's largest scientific bookstore. And I began to pick up and read a book on biological evolution after another. And I became increasingly fascinated because I realized that the account of how we got to be here that was told in these supposedly scientific books was really the creation story of our culture. It was the explanation of where we came from, how we got to be here, and how we fit into the general scheme of things. And as I read book after book, I began to see deep and pervasive intellectual flaws in the entire system. And I began to think about writing something about this. I well remember the first night when I began to think about that. I remarked to Kathy at the dinner table, I said, you know, I think I understand what is wrong with this whole field. I think I understand where it went wrong, but fortunately, I'm much too smart to write anything about it, to take it up professionally or whatever, because nobody would believe me. I would become the target of ridicule and abuse. I would be dragged into deep and profound, violent controversies and so on. And I think I'll start tomorrow. that was absolutely irresistible, that prospect. Now, I'm not going to try to go through and tell you all about the scientific issues in one lecture. That really can't be done. What I can do is tell you about the kind of thinking that I saw, the kind of way words were used, the kind of logic that has been used in this field of evolution, and how that thinking led me to define a different position, a different way of looking at this subject, a different point of entry, one might say, in the controversy, which really does seem to have the potential for changing, transforming the whole way in which this subject is argued. And I can tell it to you in the form of a story of three words. That's how, at bottom, how simple it is. Knowing about the three words won't tell you everything about it. Eventually, you've got to learn a bit about the scientific evidence. But if you understand how the words are used, you won't have a great deal of difficulty, I think, in understanding how the tricks are played and how what is, in fact, not scientifically well established at all is sold to a culture as scientific fact when it's mostly a philosophy or what we might call a form of theology, atheology, anti-theology. Now, here are the words. The three words I'm going to tell you about this afternoon are creation, evolution, and science. If you understand how these words are used in the controversy, you're equipped to understand the controversy as a whole. After that, everything is just a matter of detail. And let's look at those three words. Creation, or creationism, which would be just simply a belief in creation, a doctrine of creation. Now, what is creationism? Or creation. According to the scientific textbooks, the scientific popularizers, the voices of official science, creationism is specifically young earth biblical literalism. The literal interpretation of Genesis taken to an extreme, and everything else except that is evolution. Now, that, of course, is one way to define a word. You can say creationism means an acceptance of the Genesis story in a literal way with six 24-hour days and all of the fossil remains being the effects of Noah's flood and so on. Now, however, creation, really, if you think about it, takes in a lot broader territory than that because belief in creation or creationism fundamentally just means that we are here because a creator brought about our existence for a purpose. If you believe there was a creator, you believe in creation and you are a creationist. Regardless of whether you believe that this creation occurred in six 24-hour days or over a longer period of time. Regardless of whether you believe that it was by abrupt steps or by some gradual process. Now, I'm not saying that the other questions may not be of some importance. But fundamentally, they don't define what creation is. If you believe that we are here because we were a creator brought about our existence for a purpose, you're a creationist. And, of course, that could be consistent with evolution in some sense, because you could say the creator brought about our existence by a long process, a gradual process over many millions of years. Now, the first thing to understand is that the term evolution, as it is used in the scientific literature, as it is used by all of the popularizers and propagandizers of Darwinism, as it is used by the scientific establishment, rejects creation not just in the literal Genesis sense, but in the broad sense as well. They do not use the word evolution as a word which can be consistent with creation in the way in which I've just described it. Because to them, evolution means fully naturalistic evolution. It means evolution which involved only purposeless material processes, because these are the only processes which are open to science. See, we're already bringing in all three words, creation, evolution, and science. I'll go through them, but they're interwoven. To understand what one means, you understand the others. You have to take them really all three at a time. So if we say we believe in evolution, what we are saying that we believe in the scientific understanding of the word, is not a process which God guided, not a process which God employed, directed in order to produce human beings for a purpose, but a completely materialistic, purposeless process, which is fulfilling no purpose whatsoever. So it employs only processes which are mindless and purposeless. It employs random mutation, which is just random genetic changes, which are chance, pure chance. And that's what you might call the gasoline. That's the fuel that's pushing the thing along. And the driver of this car, the steerer, that makes the changes into complex organs and organisms that produces wonders like eyes and brains, is nothing but the fact that some organisms are better at surviving and reproducing than others. That's all it is. Natural selection. So the combination of random genetic processes and natural selection produces everything that there is. God has no part in it. It's not directed. It's not going anywhere. If it happened to produce human beings, that's just an accident. If you did it again, it wouldn't. You see, that's what is meant by evolution in the scientific literature. Now, when you understand this, I think you can already see why so many of us have had so much trouble with that third category that I began by introducing, theistic evolution. You see, it's practically a contradiction in terms, isn't it? Because evolution, as it's understood in the scientific world, is undirected non-theistic evolution. So it's almost like theistic atheism, to bring these two together. And the position survives only by blurring this important definition of the point. You see, theistic evolution could be a reasonable position. It's a coherent position. If you think of evolution as something that God employed for a particular purpose, but if you think of it as a purposeless process, as undirected, then in what sense can God be employing it? So here, the ambiguity in the definition of that word evolution leads people into great confusion. So we've seen now, of course, why it is that the term evolution in its scientific usage does not allow for creation in the broad sense. It's because it's fully naturalistic, materialistic evolution that the scientists are talking about. Now, this is a tremendously dangerous way to use words, or perhaps a tremendously deceptive way to use words would be a better way to put it. Because, you see, you could teach children in school that evolution is a fact. And then if a parent comes in and says, well, you're teaching them, you know, some godless system, you see, well, the educators can say, oh, no, we're just saying that things took a long time. We're just saying that there was a certain amount of gradual change. No great theological implications in that. Well, that's what they may get in the sixth grade. But you see, by the time they're in high school, we're beginning to teach them what evolution really means. Well, you know that evolution is a fact, don't you? Well, now we're going to teach you a little bit more about what evolution means. And you'll learn that it doesn't mean just gradual change. It means purposeless change. And so you see in the scientific literature, the science educators will often complain, well, the people don't really understand evolution. A Gallup poll showed that 47% of the people of this country believe in a creation by a creator in a fairly strict sense. Another 40% believe in God-guided evolution. And all of the leading Darwinist authorities, all of the leading scientific authorities that speak about this say, oh my gosh, they don't really understand evolution at all, do they? Only 9% of the country believes in evolution in the sense in which the leading Darwinist authorities who set the educational system of the country believe in it, this naturalistic, undirected evolution. Now, why is evolution defined that way? Well, that brings in the third word, science. Because according to the dominant view in the scientific establishment today, in evolutionary biology and in other subjects as well, science, by definition, excludes everything but the material and the natural. Science can study only natural processes, only material things. It can't study spirits. You can't study God by, you know, looking through telescopes and microscopes and doing calculations. Well, actually, some people are trying to do that these days, but it's generally considered not to be a fruitful enterprise. So God is outside of science. Now, of course, see, to some people that might sound innocent. It just means that there are certain things that science can't learn then. Science is a limited thing. But to a scientific naturalist, that's the philosophical position I'm describing, and it's the dominant position in science today, what is outside of science is also outside of reality. And the reason for this is because, in their view, scientific investigation is the only way we can ever really know anything. So you see, it's not so much that God cannot exist, it's that we couldn't know anything about God if God did exist, because we wouldn't be able to find out about it through scientific investigation. And so God might as well not exist is really the position, rather than the affirmation that God does not exist, that if God does exist, he might as well not exist, because we could never have any knowledge of anything like that. So God is effectively outside of reality. Now, when you start with that assumption, you can now see why everything else follows. If there is no God, or if we have to ignore the possible existence of God, if God might as well not exist, then how did we get to be here? How did flowers, trees, birds, all of those things come to be? Well, clearly not through the action of a creator, because we've just ruled that out. Nature has to be able to do its own creating. matter has to be able to do its own growing into living things. Because there's nothing else to do it. Nothing else knowable to science. So that's why random genetic changes, random changes, and survival of the fittest have to be able to do all this creating. It's not because anybody's seen these forces doing it. They haven't seen them do it. It's because nothing else was available. Nothing else could have done it, and so random, purposeless forces must have done it. You see, it's in the basic definition of the whole subject. So the third word, science, tells us that we must credit either mutation and selection, or something very much like that, some kind of purposeless material processes with the power to do all the creating necessary to produce flowers and birds and human beings. Now, with that mindset, there, what is otherwise very inadequate evidence becomes extremely convincing. Now, I told you I'm not going to try to go through the scientific evidence in any kind of detailed way in this lecture. But I'll just use one example to show you how the mindset governs the interpretation of the evidence and how evidence that otherwise wouldn't seem to mean anything very much becomes conclusive proof of the theory. In the Midlands of England, there's a species of moth, a peppered moth, and it contains mostly light gray, mostly light-colored moths, but a very small number of dark or melanic moths, dark-colored. That's under most circumstances. The white moths greatly outnumber the black moths. Both are present in the population. But a scientist got the idea of measuring the shifting population frequencies under different conditions in this area of England, a scientist from Oxford named Kettlewell. And it turned out that when the trees were darkened due to industrial smoke and soot in the air, for a time, the percentage of dark moths in the population went up. The theoretical reason for this that was given, it's open to debate, but we'll take it for granted for our present purpose, is that the dark moths, you see, were better camouflaged against the trees. So the birds that eat the moths couldn't see them as well, so more dark moths survived, had more offspring, you get more dark moths in the population because the trees have become dark. But then when you get air pollution laws, the trees get light again. And you see, the dark moths go down in frequency in the population, the light moths go back up again, and everything is back to normal, what it was before you started having factories in the first place. That observation of shifting population frequencies in the peppered moth population, the Midlands of England, is the most important, the most frequently cited piece of evidence for the proposition that natural selection has the kind of creative power necessary to make moths and trees and scientific observers in the first place. Now, it's obviously absurd if you look at it from a skeptical position. But you see, if you know that something has to be true anyway, then even very inadequate evidence is sufficient to illustrate the process. And so to the Darwinist mind, that peppered moth observation is overwhelming proof that natural selection has the power to do something. And since it has the power to do something in a very little amount of time, presumably it has the power to do everything in a much longer period of time. Now, evidence of that kind has been used to establish what I regard as the critical affirmation of Darwinist theory. It's what I call the blind watchmaker thesis. Now, evidence of that kind has been used to establish what I regard as the critical affirmation of Darwinist theory. It's what I call the blind watchmaker thesis. Now, I like to use that term, the blind watchmaker thesis, because for reasons that should probably be clear to you by now, I hate the word evolution with a passion. I'm asked all the time by reporters, by interviewers, they say, well, you know, what do you think about evolution? Or, you know, don't you believe in evolution in some sense or whatever? And I say, what I believe is that I never should answer any question that has the word evolution in it. You see, and the reason is that the word evolution changes its meaning all the time in the conversation. If a Darwinist is debating with you, they'll say, well, you believe in evolution, don't you? You believe that there are breeds of dogs, St. Bernards and Chihuahuas. These have come about as a result of dog breeders, haven't they? Well, we call that evolution. So you believe in evolution. In when I was debating a leading Darwinist spokesman on Wisconsin Public Radio, I asked for a definition of evolution. She said, you know, evolution is a fact. I said, well, what is the fact? What's evolution? And she said, things change. What? You're going to deny that things change? You see, but if you agree and you say, oh, okay, well, then I believe in evolution. Right. That word means fully naturalistic evolution, taking in the whole history of life from the beginning to the end. You'll find out what it really means a little later. You've bought into the key concept, you see. Now we'll tell you more about what it means later on. So I hate that word evolution, and I like to use much more precise terminology. And so I like to talk about the blind watchmaker thesis. Now that word, the blind watchmaker thesis, it comes from the title of a book called The Blind Watchmaker by an English evolutionary biologist named Richard Dawkins. And it happens to be the very first book which I picked up in that London bookstore that I told you about. And Dawkins, by the way, is a guy who's made a career as something of an anti-evangelist. In Britain, he's sort of the Billy Graham of atheism. He's continually in controversies, writing in letters to the Times of London and other newspapers, attacking Christians for this or that. The BBC, the British Broadcasting Company, arranged for him to give a special Christmas series for children, showing them how evolution had shown that there is no God. I kid you not. So he really makes a career of using this for atheistic purposes. And so Dawkins is a really good one to use here, and his title is a very good illustrative a theme. But what is the blind watchmaker thesis? It's the crucial claim of Darwinism. And here's how Dawkins sets it up. He says, at the beginning of the book, he says, biology is the study of what of things that appear to be created by a creator for a purpose. He says, of things which are so complex that it appears that they were created by a creator for a purpose. That's biology. But that's what you would think, you know, if you didn't know any better. But if you have read Dawkins and studied it, you know that this appearance is an illusion. Why? Because they were not produced by a creator, but by the processes of mutation and selection. That in fact, the great wonders of complexity, the human organs like the kidney and the heart, you know, just your limbs, the eyes, the hearing apparatus, the mind, all of these things that seem so complicated, so full of intricate working parts, complicated systems that all have to be in existence working with each other for anything to work at all, even just in one single cell, let alone in the complex organisms of the body as a whole, Dawkins says all of this was in fact produced by mutation and selection. And mutation and selection is the blind watchmaker. Blind, says Dawkins, because it has no purposes. It does not plan ahead. You see, it's just what happens to be produced today and what happens to outlive the other things so that it's still alive tomorrow, so that it produces children, offspring, so that those things dominate the next generation. That's the blind watchmaker thesis. And it's the crucial claim of Darwinism because it's the one that says there's no need for a God. Nothing for a God to do. Nothing for a creator to create. Because you can believe in a creator if you want to, but get rid of the creator and things go along just as well. Because mutation and selection can do it all. Well, now, where does the blind watchmaker thesis come from? Well, now, it's at this point that you really see the crucial deception of the entire process. Because the blind watchmaker thesis purports to be the outcome of scientific investigation. See, we say, we're up here, we're scientists, we've done this work with our microscopes, with our telescopes, with our calculations, we've brought our expert techniques to bear, and we tell you as scientists that although you might have thought, steeped in your ignorance as you are, that it requires a creator to produce these wonders, that is not in fact true. We know that it does not, because we know that the blind watchmaker, mutation and selection, can do it. Well, how do we know it? Well, we know it because all of the evidence shows it. Now, the evidence is evidence like those peppered moths. But we know that the peppered moths show it because science investigates only the material and the natural. And something very much like mutation and selection must have done all of these things, or they wouldn't be here for us to admire. So you see, we know that natural selection and random mutation must be the answer because they follow from our basic philosophical position. And hence, every little thing that we see that selection could do, even just changing the relative frequency of dark and light moths, shows that natural selection can create. And since it's the only thing that possibly could have done the creating, the only conclusion open to you is that this process, over a long period of time, did all the work of designing and creating. So that on the one hand, we start out by assuming a philosophical materialism. Matter is really all that there is. In the beginning, there was nothing but hydrogen. And matter is all that there is. And that because we have that assumption, we see that blind materialistic processes must have been able to create. And because we start out with that assumption, the evidence, which might seem to a skeptic to be very, very slight to non-existent, persuades us that mutation and selection really can do all of that creating. And so now we've proved at the end of the scientific investigation that this is how things were brought about. In short, what we've proved is the assumption we started out with at the beginning. That, by the way, was the essential insight that I started out with and told my wife that I thought was the essential problem that was wrong with the whole system. It was circular reasoning. It had assumed its conclusions, you see, in its initial premises. And if you don't make that assumption, you see that the evidence that, in fact, these purposeless natural processes can produce, can create everything that we have, is weak to non-existent. Now, if it's all that simple, you might say, why hasn't somebody blown the whistle on this long ago? Why don't they get it, you know, how does it last? What keeps it going? Well, we've got to go back to those words, the same words we started to. Now I'm going to go back to that word science again and tell you something more about what that word science means. You've already seen that science means the study of what is material and natural. And that with science defined that way, the only way in which science can explain why you and I are here or why there are flowers and trees is as the result of purposeless natural processes. I'm sure that that's clear by now. So science assumes that some such process did all the creating, and it has this theory, the Darwinian theory, which satisfies a lot of people in the scientific world. Now suppose you say, well, I don't believe that theory is true. I don't believe those forces of mutation and selection can do all of that creating. Do you know what you will be answered with? What is your alternative? What is your alternative? Now at this point, you can only make one of two moves, and both of them are wrong. You could say, well, my alternative is God created. You see why that's wrong? That's outside of science. That's not science. We put that aside in our very definition of science. So you're not talking about science, you're talking about religion. You go over there to the church, or, you know, but don't bother the serious people who are trying to find out how things really happen, because that's for science. And you have made a suggestion that's outside of science. So that's a foul ball. Strike one. You say, well, all right, let's forget about God. We won't talk about God. I'll obey the rules. How about we don't know? Strike two. Because that's every bit as much against the rules as God did it. The reason is that science is defined, you will be told, I've been told on countless occasions, as a process which continually progresses from relatively inferior explanations of things to relatively superior explanations. And you see, to simply say the theory that you've got, well, it has certain flaws. All right, every theory, you know, doesn't explain quite everything. Some details need to be filled in and so on. But we've got this theory. And if you say you want scientists to throw out that theory, to say that it's not true, and to substitute nothing but we don't know, that's outside the rules of science every bit as much as God is. What you must do is you must propose a better alternative. And the alternative must satisfy the philosophical ground rules. That is, it must be involve nothing but material processes that are purposeless and naturalistic. So, you see, the question then becomes not what is true, but what is the best naturalistic and materialistic speculation anybody's produced about how we could have gotten here, assuming that there's no God? And if that's the question, Darwinism is the correct answer. You can't improve on that, or nobody's been able to improve on it, in the confines of materialistic and naturalistic philosophy. And you see that happen, if you're aware of the history of Darwinian theory, in every generation there has been some eminent scientist who has stepped forward and said, you know, the evidence is just dead against this entire theory. If something we might call evolution happened, it didn't happen in the way this theory says. It happened in big mysterious jumps or something like that. They'll say, that's what the evidence seems to say. And their colleagues will say, what is your alternative? And a person will come up with some attempt to make an alternative because they're trying to be within science. And they'll say, well, there was a giant mutation that changed a reptile into a bird all in one generation, one fell swoop. One example was a very eminent scientist said that, well, maybe a reptile's egg hatched and a bird emerged, a snake's egg hatched and a bird emerged. Well, that's no better than supernatural creation, you see. How did that happen? You don't have a scientific explanation for that. That's not science. That's a miracle. And so it isn't a satisfactory substitute for all the, you know, disadvantage of mutation and selection. It's better than that. Maybe against the evidence, but at least it's sort of a plausible, coherent explanation of how you could build up complexity by tiny stages. And so, you see, the official theory stands because it's not been replaced by something superior. So you can't say God did it, and you can't say we don't know. We have to know, and it has to not involve God. And on those assumptions, you see, Darwinism is just about the best that anybody can do. It's science. And if you ask the question, well, it's science, but is it true? Then you really have missed some essential step in the reasoning. Because, you see, it's science, it's better than truth. Because truth might be just your truth. You know, people will say, well, you know, you believe in Jesus Christ or in any, I mean, in any doctrine or whatever. Well, that's true for you. It works in your life. You've probably heard that or something. You know that. Just don't foist it on anybody else. But that's true for you. That's subjective knowledge. It's valid only for the individual. But science, you see, is valid for everybody. It's objective knowledge. It's true for everybody. And that, by the way, is why it isn't dogmatic for the science education establishment to want to teach everybody's children that evolution, whatever that might mean, is a fact. That's not being dogmatic because that's science. That's valid for everybody. But if you want to say, we want to tell the other side of the story and question that and ask whether creation might be true, that's being dogmatic to try to put that position. Because, you see, you're taking something that is only, by its inherent nature, truth for the individual because it can't be science. And you're trying to make it true for everybody by presenting it as if it were a rational doctrine. So you see that as the rules work, only this kind of an explanation can be allowed. Or to put it another way, the blind watchmaker thesis is simply true by definition. It follows from the rules of the knowledge game that we've set down. And if the precise Darwinian theory that's being taught today isn't true, then something very much like it has to be. You see, it wouldn't be very different whatever is the ultimate truth. So science can improve, but whatever it is for now, it's science, and it's effectively truth for us. Now, of course, this isn't something that's just important for science classes. This isn't something which is just important for the profession of science. And I think you can see what's of general importance about this whole area from what I've just been saying in the past few minutes. That because scientific investigation deals only with the material and the naturalistic, that which is outside of science can never be anything but a matter of subjective belief. See how that follows from the same system? You'll see how that follows. Now, what is outside of science is things like value, like morality. You see, morals, right and wrong, can only be a matter of individual opinion because it is not scientifically determined. It can't be valid for everybody. And hence, relativism in moral and ethical matters is inherently implied by the very nature of this knowledge system. Now, I'll illustrate that by just a brief passage from a review of my book, Darwin on Trial. I had the honor to be the recipient of three full pages of vindictive abuse in the Scientific American from the leading proponent of Darwinism in America, Harvard professor Stephen Jay Gould, in the July issue of Scientific American. I won't go over all the points. It's a lot of fun if you enjoy Johnson bashing, as I do. But I'll just go into one point that Professor Gould made. He was critical of me for saying that Darwinian science, the system I've just described to you, was inherently tended towards naturalism and atheism and was inherently opposed to any meaningful theistic religion. And he denied this. He said that it was unkind and untrue of me to say that scientists were being insincere when they claimed to have equal respect for science and religion. And what he said was, that's not true at all. He said, I regard the two, that is science and religion, as of equal dignity and limited contact. They do not conflict because science treats factual reality while religion struggles with human morality. See? Science, they're entirely different realms. Science treats factual reality while religion struggles with human morality. And he said they are separate but equal. Now, you know what separate but equal means. It means that somebody rides in the back of the bus. And in this case, of course, the exclusive authority of science to interpret factual reality means that the struggle for morality, which Professor Gould says is all religion is allowed to do, is carried on in terms dictated by science. It cannot involve, for example, a god, except as a matter of subjective belief, you see, because it's only science can say that something is real. God can't be factually real because God is outside of science. Nor can there be any natural moral principles that are objective and valid for everybody. And in fact, earlier in the same review, Professor Gould offhandedly states that, of course, everybody knows that there's no such thing as natural law or an objective moral law out there to be discovered. You see, why not? Well, it would be unknown to science. So that if you're wondering why moral relativism wins all of the arguments, it wins all of the arguments because all intellectual discourse today, all intellectual argument, all theorizing takes place in the shadow of the rules of knowledge that Darwinism illustrates. The rules that say that we can get objective knowledge only from science, that outside of science we have only subjective belief, and there one person's opinion is as good as another. And each does what is good in his or her own eyes. And that's all that there can be to it. Well, I think you can see why it is that I decided that this subject was the one that really had to be taken up before I could take up anything else. And one can put the whole message really simply. If you want to know how we ought to live, what we ought to do, what our purpose is, what we're here for, how we ought to behave, how we ought to lead our lives, the way you start to answer those sorts of questions is you say, how did we get to be here? Where did we come from? Where are we going? And especially, are we responsible to a being who brought us into existence and who cares about us? Or are we, to take another creation, a story, the products of a blind, purposeless material process that cares nothing for us? That's the message of the Darwinian theory of evolution, which is indeed what evolution means when the meaning is fully brought out in the scientific discourse. And of course, all of this is or should be an old story to all of us because it's the whole story of the Bible. And especially, if I wanted to pick out a part of the Bible to talk about in this occasion, I wouldn't pick out Genesis. I'd pick out Romans 1. Because it's in the first chapter of Romans where we're told that to the common sense mentality, the existence, the power and majesty of the Creator is apparent to all people just as a matter of their natural perception. Or to put it in Richard Dawkins' words, biology would seem to be the study of complex things which were brought about into existence by a creator for a purpose. But Romans 1 also tells us that it is an inherent part of fallen human nature that people try to escape from this knowledge and that they make up philosophical systems in order to hide this reality from them and that they end in idolatry and nature worship. That they end by worshiping the blind forces of nature as their creator instead of the true creator. And, of course, from that choice, their philosophy becomes vain speculation, and thinking to be wise, they become as fools. And the culture that builds itself on that foundation
Well, I don't think I have to fill that in for you. I think you can see where the culture that builds itself on that foundation is headed. Thank you all very much for coming, and now I'm ready to take questions from the audience in whatever time we have left. Yes, sir. No, I proposed to the Scientific American that they give me equal space for a column of my own, and I actually wrote it. And of course, they refused to publish it. It's being very widely distributed by friends, and is being sent out to a huge mailing list. You see, you must understand, this is not book reviewing. This is not academic discourse. This is something more on the nature of warfare, because it's tremendously important to this, the Darwinian establishment, that no one get wind of the notion that there is a genuine critique of intellectual merit against their position. That it, you know, it's only things that they can afford to ignore, so they're not going to print something like my column. Yes, sir. Oh, to try to get the Darwinist leaders into a discussion of their terms and defining them, they won't do it. You know, some will. There's a professor at Cornell who is a very ardent atheist and who uses Darwinism to establish atheism, and he's disgusted with his colleagues because they won't admit that they repudiate creation in the broad sense. And he thinks that that should be made explicit. Of course, you see, they don't want to do that because it's important to their strategy that people be lulled to sleep on this. And also, they want to be able to tell people, there's no reason for you to be concerned about this. You have no right to challenging it because it's just a matter of professional interest. It doesn't affect you. So they want to make a very subtle message on this. And this Professor Provine is bringing it out in the open. In that sense, he's almost an ally. He's invited me, by the way. I'm going to speak at his class at Cornell on this subject next month. Did you have a follow-up? Well, you know, the question is, it sounds conspiratorial. I think the better way to understand it is this. It's not that people get up in the morning and say, we're going to tell lies, you know, and so on. It's that you have to understand the tremendous power of a metaphysical system over the mind. They think in these categories. They cannot conceive of a truth which is superior to science under the rules as they apply it. And they think of evolution, you know, as something which is so obviously true that it's just, sort of everything. The power this has in the mind. I heard a Christian professor of human genetics speaking recently at a convention who was speaking of the future evolution of the human race. And you know what he was talking about? All of his examples were the evolution of the human race, mutations and selection. It was Down syndrome, Tay-Sachs disease, genetic mutations that are all harmful, and this was evolution. I said, shouldn't you have a different word? Because evolution is the great creative process that, you know, brought us all into being from the first living cell. Oh, no, that's the way we do it in science. And that's the answer to every one of these points. That's how we do it in science.
For those who are interested in further study, Professor Johnson has several books, audio, and videotapes available, including study kits available for individual, group, and classroom use. To find out more information, you can contact Access Research Network at P.O. Box 38069, Colorado Springs, Colorado, 80937-8069. They also have a website at www.arn.org. They also have a toll-free voicemail order line at 1-888-259-7102. Professor Johnson's book, Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds, is highly recommended as a general introduction to this subject.